It's now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, as you just heard, 10 years of sobriety. Let's give it up for James.
Wow, it's an honor and a privilege to be here tonight to share my message of hope with you guys. It's been a journey. And since I've been in the program, I have been able to characterize my recovery, basically my life, in series of moments. And I've been able to get through those moments by practicing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and relying on a higher power that I choose to call God to help me in those baffling situations, those baffling times when they come up. But I'm going to share a little bit, you know, we share our experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. When I first realized I had a drinking problem, it was in high school. But before then, my first drink was at 9 years old. 9 years old. And I told a fib to get my first drink. Alcoholic. Maybe I was alcoholic at nine. I don't know. But anyway. And I was brought up in a very spiritual home. Pull this down a little bit. And my father, he was the kind of man that if you went and party Saturday night, Sunday morning, you're going to church, regardless, hangover or not. Well, this particular Sunday morning, I told my mother, you know, to ease this awful way, that I wasn't feeling too good. But I had a neighbor live behind us. His name was Mr. Robert. Robert heard it, remember him right now today. And every morning, Sunday morning, he would sit out in his yard with a six-pack of 16-ounce Old Milwaukee. That's why I was sick. I didn't want to go to church. I wanted to go see Mr. Robert. And so my mom told me, all right, you stay home, stay in bed. So the rest of my siblings, my parents, they went to church. As soon as they left, I got out of bed, and I went over there and commenced to talking with Mr. Robert. Now, this is where it get kind of vague or froggy. I don't know if I asked him for a beer or he offered me a beer. But I remember him saying this, don't you tell your daddy where you got that beer from. No, Mr. Robert, I'm not going to tell him. I promise, you know. And so I had to make it back home and get back in bed and pretend like I was still sick and do the mouthwash thing, you know, so my mom, when she come home, she wouldn't smell it. Well, that kind of set off that getting away with it. I got away with it. Nothing happened. No consequences. So that started my getting away with stuff as I progress on in life. And I said when I first realized it was in high school, senior year, and I used to hang around with some boys that my dad didn't feel too kindly about. And my dad would say, I don't want you hanging around with them boys. Well, as soon as my dad turned a corner, guess where I went? To hang around with them boys. You know, and these were the type of friends that liked to, you know, we didn't have any jobs, you know, but we would pool our money together. You know, dollar here, $2 there, whatever. And we wasn't old enough to buy it, but we had a practicing alcoholic in the neighborhood. Basically, he was a wino, and we called him Ned the Wino. That was his name, Ned. Everybody knew him. Everybody in the community in the neighborhood knew of Ned. We wouldn't let nobody mess with Ned. He was something like the mascot of the neighborhood. So we would get Ned to go in the liquor store to buy us what we want to drink. And on the thing, Ned, you know, we tell Ned he can have the change. He don't want the change. He wants the first drink out the bottle. Ned, we don't know where your mouth been. You got a cup, you know, we'll pour you some. Well, anyway, so one particular morning, Monday morning after Sunday night, we all got together and we was going to meet up before school started. Morning was in the wintertime. Somebody brought the gin and juice. Somebody brought, that was me, I brought the Valiums, okay? I had to hit my mom medicine cabinet. Somebody brought the weed and all that kind of stuff. So we would meet behind this apartment complex right across the street from the school, and that's where we would commence to, you know, partying before class. And I had a test that morning. I mean, we didn't kill the fifth of gin. And when I get in there and I'm doing my test, and it's in the wintertime, and all of a sudden, I started sweating. You know, cold sweat. Just started sweating profusely. And I asked the teacher, can I be excused? He came over and looked at my test. He said, well, James, you only got one more question to do. Why don't you? I said, man, I can't do it. I need to go to the bathroom right now. Well, he said, all right, go ahead, but you can't come back and do this test. You just want one last question. I said, okay, that's fine. As soon as I walked out the classroom, everything went black. Everything went black. Now, I had a mental note in my mind how far the bathroom was from the classroom that I left. And in between the classroom that I left out of and the bathroom, it was another classroom. So I'm doing the wall crawl. I can't see anything, but I'm feeling on the wall. And then when I get there, I get in this open space, which was that other classroom, and I'm groping for air, you know. Get on the other side, and I go in the bathroom, and I fall on the tile floor. That cold tile floor felt so good. But that teacher saw me doing that, and he came, what's wrong with that guy? So he comes in the bathroom, and he sees me laying on me. I'm hugging this tile floor. And he said, look at you, you messed up. He didn't use the word messed up. He used another word. And I looked up, and, oh, what are you talking about, you know? So they sent me to the principal office, called the guidance council. They came down and stuff and sent me home, called my mom. She came get me. So I get home, and I'm still trying to play it off. I know mom can smell the alcohol on me. So she just got me in the house and said, go sleep it off. And that's what I did. And I slept it off. So I continue hanging around with those boys my dad didn't want me to hang around with. And my alcoholism, to me, I don't think I really realized that I had an alcohol problem. To me, it was having a good time. You know, 17, 18 years old, I'm still experimenting, trying to, you know. But that blackout that I had, that was the first sign that I probably had a problem. To make it even worse, 1981, I joined the service, Uncle Sam's Army. And in boot camp, in Fort Dix, New Jersey, I'm a southern boy. Let me tell you, I'm from Mississippi. I'm a southern boy. We don't get too much snow down south. So they sent me up to Fort Dix, New Jersey. Nothing but snow, 50, wind chill factor 50 below zero, you know. So I had fire guard. They sit you in the hallway and you while everybody else sleeping, you making sure no fire start off. But only thing that they would allow us to have is NyQuil. Alcohol percentage on NyQuil is okay, you know, so I kind of stacked up on NyQuil. And so I continued drinking through basic, left basic, went to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, I'm back in the sun. Now here, my company commander told me, he said, you're still on Uncle Sam time, but you have some free time. Basically, you can go take care of your personal business, but you know, you can't go and just start drinking. Well, that part I didn't hear. I didn't hear that part. First place I went after formation dismissed was straight to the PX. Sat there, got me a big pitcher of beer, sat there, you know, I'm a private eat nothing, drinking. And here's my company commander. He come through and he see my insignia on my shoulder, and he asked me for my identification, military ID. I'm on a military installation. And I didn't know this rule, but some veterans told me about it later. So I got up, went in my wallet, took my military ID out, and I handed it to him. And he turned around and walked off. And some old... like I said, some veterans were sitting over there, and they saw what happened. They said, come here, young soldier. They said, why did you give that officer your... I said, well, he asked for it. They said, well, that's one order you can refuse. you will refuse and say, hey, I will go with you anywhere you want to take me, but I'm not relinquishing my military ID. So, and I equate that to driving, drinking and driving, and the cop pull you over, and he asks for your license, and he keep it. That's what I equate that with, you know. So that went on. So I got my first Article 15. First Article 15. I wasn't making any money. I didn't have any rank. So what are they going to do with me? So they restricted me to barracks for 2 weeks, which means I can't go to formation. I just stay in the barracks. And, you know, the camaraderie, you know, of soldiers, you know, you got a buddy, you got friends, you know. So I gave this guy $20, sent him to the PX, and I said, man, go get me a six-pack of beer. And he went and got me a six-pack of Slit Smoked Liquor Board, 16-ounce cans. And he brought them back to me. You can keep the change, you know, whatever. So I'm restricted to barracks, and I'm in there popping, just trying to get me a quick buzz, just drinking them real fast before they come around and do an inspection or something. And then after I drunk the six-pack, guess what I'm left with? Cans. Evidence. Got to get rid of the evidence. Alcoholic thinking. I'm in the barracks by myself, so I'm in there ripping up the cans. What am I doing? Toilet. Yes. Took him over to the toilet and flushed him. And guess what happened? Bagged up the toilet. So they get maintenance to come down, and he get to pulling all these little things out of there. Where did this come from? I'm the only one in the barracks. I don't know, you know. Guess what? I got away with it again. So, hell, if I can keep doing that and getting away with it, why give it up, you know? But anyway, get out of the military, 8 years, 89, from 81 to 89, get out of the military, get back into society, continue to drink and continue to do stuff. Made a geographical from Mississippi to Houston, Texas, drinking continued. From Houston, Texas, I ended up in Oakland, California. And in Oakland, California, I used to work for Marriott Courtyard, engineering department, maintenance, basically. And engineering or maintenance, guess what you guys have? Keys to everything, including the bar. And I used to take the shuttle and drive down to Oakland International Airport and pick up airline crews coming in. And, you know, red eye out of JetBlue coming out of, you know, New York or something. And the first thing those guys want is a drink, but a bar closes at 8. So one of the crew members said, hey, James, you think, you know, it's $10, $15. You think you can give me a drink? Oh, yeah, what room you in? So I go there and I open up the liquor cabinet and I get him what he wanted, take it up to his room, give it to him. And I was working the night shift. So now I had this brilliant idea, since I'm there by myself, the hotel have certain rooms that they call out-of-order rooms. They don't rent them out. Wallpaper might be falling down, no television or something, air conditioner not working. So I would go and post up in an out-of-order room. And this particular night, I got bored. Nothing to do, is a quiet night. So, you know, that movie Flight with Denzel Washington in the hotel, yeah. I go down there and I get me a fifth of liquor and I go back up in the out-of-order room and I sit there and I, you know, and if front desk need me, they had a walkie-talkie, hey, you know, engineering or James, we need you, you know, and I will wake up and go and see what they need. So I ended up getting drunk and my shift was over at 7 o'clock in the morning. And they don't want you on premises after your shift. After your shift, you go home. I'm passed out. My supervisor came in at 7 o'clock. And now I'm trying to sneak off the premises without getting caught. Didn't do it. I didn't get away with it that time. So they called me. So they gave me a verbal reprimand and, you know, and just told me this is policy. You can't be here. So that just goes to show you how my drinking continued. So 9/11 happened. This I ended up in the beautiful city of Visalia. 9/11 happened, so they kind of grounded the flights. No, nothing flying. I was the last one hired, the first one laid off. And I ended up having a fiance. She was the cook there. And they ended up, you know, she getting laid off too. So we both got laid off. She had a sister live in Hanford. So we relocated from Oakland to Hanford to stay with her sister for a little while. And drinking continued. And then we found a place over here on Douglas and Ben Maddox. Those apartments over there, Holiday Homes, you go a little further back. Yeah, some of you guys were sure. Yeah, okay. See, I got one of my fellow friends here. Yeah, so... So I ended up getting married. Now, this is the tricky part about my marriage. I gave her a ring, but I don't remember asking her, will you marry me? I don't remember that part. I remember giving her a ring. Next thing I know, she got wedding invitations and told her family and I'll meet the family and all this and invited me to her church and everybody know me. So I just went with the program, you know. So here I am married. And she liked to entertain. She had a one of those carts, decanters, you know, you got the decanter, the little wheels on the little glass and copper carts. She used to keep it in the hallway. And she was working. I was unemployed. I was getting unemployment. So she would go to work, and when she was at work, she liked to drink brandy, E&J. She would fill up that container. When she come home, it's empty. What happened to all the liquor? I said, what do you mean, what happened to all the liquor? She said, that was for company. I was like, crap. I didn't say crap. I used another word. I live here. I should be able to get a drink whenever I want to. Well, she didn't kind of like that idea. So anyway, she ended up leaving. And I think, you know, after a period of time, you know, they get sick and tired of that alcohol, you know. So she ended up packing up everything. She got a U-Haul. She packed up everything. Her father got us $5,000 worth of apartment furniture. She took everything, left me an apartment, carpet on the floor, blinds on the windows, paint on the walls. And went back to Oakland. So here I am trying to make this thing work for me. I got to become the maintenance person of the apartment complex. And the landlord would kind of cut my rent down so I can afford it. And I ended up doing some more stuff to try to supplement my income. We're not going to get into that. But I continued to drink. And then sooner or later, I couldn't afford to fit the bill. So I ended up losing my apartment. So I lost my apartment in 2005. And I'm on the streets of Visalia. I'm homeless. And pretty much, you know, they say causes and conditions, things that happen in our life that we don't want to deal with. So I pretty much gave up on James. Man, you can't hold a marriage down, you can't hold a job down, all these things, you know. So I just confine myself or just put myself that this is the way I'm going to live, a homeless person. And I lived that way for 8 years on the streets of Visalia. And now we're going to get to another incomprehensible, demoralizing story. I ended up getting a bicycle. And I used to ride my bicycle from Get and Go to liquor store all around Visalia. But my main place was Tony Get and Go up on Ben Maddox and Douglas. Now, to get you to the point, I want to support my drinking. I don't have a job, so what I do, I post up in front of this guy's establishment like it was my right to trouble his customers. And I would say, hey guy, can I pump your gas for a little change? Can I wash your windows for a little change? Can I carry a 24-pack of beer to your car? Hoping you give me one and you hoping I don't run off with it. I'm that guy. I'm that guy that when you pull up to the convenience store, you lock your door and you walk around to avoid me. Yeah, you guys have done that. You know what I'm talking about. I'm that guy. And it got real bad. Me and the store owner, Tony, I love him to death right now. But me and Tony had a hate relationship. He didn't want me bothering his customers, and I felt it was my right, being an American citizen, to do what I want to do. Selfish, self-centered. Even got to the point Tony would call the cops on me, I would call the cops on him. Seriously. Tony would use the N-word, you know, he of Arab descent or whatever, and I would use the S-N-word. That's how our relationship was. Okay? But, you know, and then the cops would come there and they would say, well, just don't visit his establishment. And I'm like, man, this is my spot. Where else am I going to go? You know? So, and then, you know, the cop would come there, and then I'm trying to file a report on him. I said, I think he's a terrorist, you know? I think he's a terrorist, you know? Because, you know, most people go, you know, United States of America or USA. But in our relationship, that hate, he would go U.S. a-hole. And see, and that hurt my feelings, you know. You don't talk about my country like that, you know. So anyway, things went on, and I used to ride my bike over to Lee's Get and Go over there on Court also. It's another spot. And I used to ride by this one particular house. And I used to see all kind of people just like you guys standing out in the parking lot, standing out in the driveway talking. And I would ride by there and I would always wonder, man, what's going on over there? And that place is my home group right now, Bridge Street Drunks Only. Yeah. But I would ride by that place and I never knew what was going on over there. But I would see all type of people out there just having a good time and chopping it up. And over behind the Get and Go on Ben Maddox and Douglas, it was a Star Hat Pizza, and behind Star Hat Pizza, they had some little cubby holes. That used to be my bed. That's where I go to sleep at. I get me a cardboard box in the wintertime, cover up, got bottle in hand, sitting there getting drunk. And one night, I look up at the stars. I had a moment of clarity. And I said, man, there's got to be something bigger and better than this. And I said, God, help me. I don't want to live like this no more. The best, honest, and sincere prayer I ever said. So sincere, I wouldn't have been surprised if a bolt of lightning would have struck me and say, voila, you're clean and sober. That's how seriously I wanted to help. But I also come to realize that this don't happen on my time. It happens on God's time. And God put series of events together. He didn't tell me about them, but he put them together. So I'm riding my bike past Bridge Street one day behind the Creative Center, our old place where we used to have meetings, a Wednesday or speaker meeting. And lo and behold, on Douglas, here come a cop. I got a 40-ounce of beer in a bag leaving Lee's Get and Go, and I turned off Race on the Bridge Street behind the Creative Center, and this cop turned off Douglas on the Creative Center, so we finna intercept. Good. With an open container. And it's something I don't never do. When I see a cop and I got an open container, I'm going to hide it or I'm going to turn off. But this particular day, the cop get right up and we intercept, and guess what I do? How you doing, officer? Wave at him with a 40-ounce open container. And you know what he had to do his job. He busted a U-turn, got behind me, poured the beer out. The bike went in the trunk. I went in the back seat, down the main jail of public intoxication. So, At the time, I thought I was getting arrested. But then I remember that prayer that I asked God to help me. I didn't want to live like this anymore. So that was a divine intervention that I still hold true today, that God did for me what I can do for myself. Because I normally wouldn't wave at a cop. Beer or no beer. But I did. And so Judge Couillard, he wanted to put me into outpatient. New Heights, down by Glitz Meat Market at the time. I'm homeless, mind you. I don't need no outpatient. You give me outpatient, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out. And that's what I did. I would go and do my little, you know, one-on-ones, my little council meeting and all that. And after that, I would get on my bike and I would go back to what I'm familiar with, Douglas and Ben Maddox. Until one day I went into New Heights and one of the counselors, as soon as I walked through the door, he pointed at me, James, I got to make a phone call on you. This guy's been to call somebody I don't want him to call. Probation, police. He said, go to Pine. They got a bed waiting on you. Go there. Another scary and best decision I ever made. Usually, he didn't say, hold on, James, I'm going to take you to Pine. He said, go to Pine. So I got to make a choice. So I'm riding my bike from New Heights by Glitz Meat Market, and I get right there by the library, Locust and Murray. I'm on the other side of the road. I'm not on Pine side. I'm on the other side. And Pine right here. And I'm on that bike and I'm shaking. Part of me saying go to Ben Maddox and Douglas, and part of me say go to Pine. I almost got hit, but I made that right turn. Made that right turn, parked my bike out front, and I walked up those steps. And when I went there, the intake guy, Mark, I remember him right now today, he said, hey, we thought you weren't going to make it. Well, here I am. What's happening, you know? So they get me there to do the intake. And they put me in a room, and they call it the animal house. I'm insane. I'm crazy. So they put me in a room with some more insane and crazy people. You know, so basically, Animal House was like, you can go here, you can break some rules, we're not going to hold against you, you can detox. I didn't have to go to detox, but, you know, they said, you know, you can kind of get familiar, slowly increment you into the program. But you got away with a lot of stuff, and I'm used to getting away with stuff. So now, I'm there in Animal House, and then after about a week or two, you know, and some clarity then came back, then they moved me to another room with some more bunkies. They call it First Step. Okay, First Step. I'm an alcoholic. I don't have a life. I'm existing, but I don't have a life. You know when they say your life is unmanageable? I didn't have a life. I was just existing. I admitted that. And I admitted that my life is a mess. And I kind of got into the program a little bit. Now, Pine had a ritual that they used to do. I did 90 days there. They had a ritual that once you completed your program at Pine, out in the little courtyard there, they used to have a big orange water cooler. And whenever someone complete the program, they will douse you, just, you know, like a football team, you know, they douse the coach. So when my 90, you know, it's like, okay, you're welcome to the fraternity or something, but, you know, when my 90 day was up, nobody didn't want to douse me, didn't want to baptize me. To me, I looked at it as getting baptized. Nobody wanted to dump me, you know, and I kind of mentioned it to one of my guys. I said, man, why don't, you know, so he kind of put the word out and kind of called me off guard and, hey, all right, you know, I'm a part of. Okay? So, I wasn't ready. I've been in this program 13 years to have 10 years of continuing sobriety. So those first 3 years that I'm talking about, I wasn't ready. So I had the desire, but I wouldn't. I had a reservation. So when I left Pine, it's like a baby. Pine was my safe place. To me, it was my safe place. And I equate that to like a baby in his mom's womb. Nice and warm and everything. And then all of a sudden, what the hell is this? Life. What the hell is this? So when I left Pine, I go back into society. I don't know how to do life. You know, so this person let me sleep in her garage to help her out with some chores around the house, you know, the yard and stuff like that. That was my room and board, you know. And she had a son named Robert. He was like maybe 17. So he was experimenting with drinking too, you know. So I'm trying to get this program and trying to make it work. And my birthday came up, 2006 by now. And Robert had a whole case of beer. And I'm going to Pine meeting, you know, I'm going to Pine, you know, noon meeting, you know, I'm trying to just do the meeting, 90 meetings, 90 days, you know, I go there. And on my birthday, Robert came, he said, hey, James, come on, James, have a beer with me for your birthday. I said, man, I'm in recovery, man. I don't want one. I'm in recovery. That lasted for about 15 hours. I'm telling him I'm in recovery. And then in the wee hours of the night, when everybody's in the house asleep, Rob still got that case of beer, you know, upstairs in his room. He wasn't asking me to have a beer with him no more. My alcoholic brain, James, go get one. Won't nobody know. So I went up there. Hey, Robert, you still got some beer? Oh, hey, James, here you go. And I thought I was doing something brilliant. My birthday. I'm breaking my sobriety. I'm relapsing. So I'm going to have my sobriety date and my birthday on the same day. I'm thinking now, since I done broke it. So on the 11th. July 11th, 2006, I go back to one of those meetings at Pine, and I admitted to the group that I relapsed. And I said, my sobriety day is 7/10/2006, and this guy, I can't remember his name, but he pointed out a fascinating fact. He said, so you drunk on your birthday? I said, yeah. He said, and today it's 11. He said, did you have a drink today? I said, no. He said, well, that's not your sobriety date. He said, your sobriety date is 7-11 now. Not 7. I'm like, oh, man, I messed that up. You know, but anyway. So I was back out there for a while. And 2009 is when I finally had that moment of clarity. I was introduced to Bridge Street Drunks by Sylvia. And I have her daughter and her husband right there, you know. I've been with them since they were 8 years old, and her and her son, her brother, you know, they're twins. And she introduced me to Bridge Street. And they used to go to meetings with me. I used to run a 10-step group over there, and Sylvia would be working, and I would take the kids with me. And Billy, at the time, he had a partition door. They would go back there in the door while we do the 10-step meeting and stuff. And things went on, man. The things was going great. So now I got off the streets. You know, I got an apartment. I got a family. I have a car. I still had my bike, but I had a car. And doing the deal. 2009, how my sobriety date got to be Cinco de Mayo. Over near the apartment complex, we had some Hispanic neighbors. that like to start partying early. Early. Jose Cuervo. And I guess he got the guy, he got in some trouble with his wife and stuff, and so he wanted to stop drinking after that and relapsed again. Okay, so they start partying on the third and fourth, and by the fifth, man, hey, I'm done, dude. Y'all, I can't handle it. I can't hang with y'all. I understand, but I can't hang. So that was my last drink, you know, Cuatro de Mayo, the fourth. And I remember in my apartment complex, I was taking the garbage out. I'm still new, and I'm still recalling from alcohol like it's a hot flame. And I shared this story with my dear friend here. I was taking my garbage can out to the dumpster one evening, and lo and behold, on the side of the dumpster was a fifth of Jose Cuervo. I threw the whole garbage can, not the bag, everything, in the dumpster and ran back in the house. True story. And I shared that with my dear friend here. He was like, man, next time just bring it over here. We can sell it, you know. My dear friend here, you know, he gave me some good suggestions, you know. James, you could have brought over here. We could have sold shots, you know. But, yeah, you know, so I haven't, you know, and I was real. I did the go into the grocery store, not walking down the alcohol aisle and all that stuff, not being around the smell of it, you know. I record from it like a hot plane. And last time I spoke at the speaker meeting was after 5 years of sobriety. I spoke at the Ice House. Bill Hatzman asked me to speak, and he's down in L.A. He asked me to speak again. So this is my 10 years. And things have really changed for me from being a hopeless, drunk, pretty much I got to the point that this is how I'm going to live, this is how I'm going to die. On the streets of Australia, homeless behind a dumpster. But God did for me, like I said, what I can do for myself, and gave me that divine intervention. And I've been a faithful member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really believe in the triangle, unity, service, recovery. And I practice that in my life today. You know, GSR for Bridge Street, sponsor people. But the most important thing about this program, I think, is the unity. Look at us. People who wouldn't normally mix, look at us. The unity, man, of the fellowship. Because guess what? We all want to be a part of something. We want to belong somewhere. And man, what better place to be than in a room of drunks, sober drunks. You know? Who's looking for that way out? That way out of that. I used to consider it like on a record player, when your needle gets stuck in a groove. Same thing over and over. That's how my life was for a minute. But thank God I had that moment of clarity and I jumped track. I don't even know what the whole song gonna be yet. But I'm not listening to the same tune. Which is a blessing, you know, and that's why I say it's an honor and a privilege, man, to be able to share my message of hope, to let you guys know that there is a way out. And I was at another speaker meeting, and I like sharing this story, and the story is this guy, you know, we're getting that pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing spot. I think the guy's name was Jerry. He shared this story from L.A. This guy was down in this hole, and he's hollering, help! You know, like we alcoholics, you know, we get to that point, you know. Sometimes we don't even have to yell. We either body language or isolation and stuff like that, but still those are cries for help. And this preacher came by and heard the guy hollering help, and he looked over in the hole and said, "Hey, you kind of deep down there, ain't you?" He said, "Well, I'll say a prayer for you." And, you know, he said a prayer and then went on by his way. And then here come the cops, you know, and the guy hollering help. The cop looked down there. "Man, you can't be down there. You're lottering. I'm going to give you a ticket." You know, and the cop went on by his way. And here come the old drunk. Here the guy hollering help. And he get there and he jumped down in the hole with the dude. And the dude said, "Man, why you do that? Now we both stuck down here." He said, "I've been here before. I know the way out. I know the way out." And that's what we do here. We share the message of hope. We've been here. We've been there. What it was like, we all got our own story. We've been there. Have you found a way out? I have. With a God of my understanding and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And basically, this is something I should have been doing all along until I warped my thinking with alcohol. This is a normal way of living each and every day. You know, I hear about people losing their kids. Well, you should have did that in the beginning. You know, I hear about people, you know, me, even myself, being homeless, you know. I should have been a productive member of society from the get-go. Why did I have to get down to that point? I love chapter 5 of this book. I love chapter 5. I love it so much that I made a point to memorize it. And I like the steps. And it's a, you know, none of us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. Willing. That's the key to unlock the door. Become willing. And then that's soul searching. You know, after you've found a God of your understanding, I don't care what it is, I know who mine is, you find your own. You know, and you do that personal inventory. Make a beginning. Just a beginning. Don't have to be perfect. Just a beginning. My first inventory, white sheet of paper, lying down the middle, searching and fearless moral inventory. Good things about James, bad things about James. Two or three good things. Bad things down and over. "Man, you're a piece of crap, ain't you, James?" But check the flip side of it out. As I started working the program, started working in the principles of the 12 steps, those bad character defects became character qualities, became assets. You know, in the fourth step, it talks about liabilities and assets. I had a whole lot of character defects, which was liability, which was basically hurting me. But I use those same, you know, we don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. But I use those same character defects to build for a positive way to work this program and to live a happy and joyous life today. That's all I got. Thank you.